It's time for Ruination Repeat, recapping last week's shows.
I'm not the only one who could use a little bit more of a big fatty.
Oh, dear Gussie, dear Gussie, dear sweet Gussie.
Welcome to this week's Ruination Repeat. I'm King.
And I'm Gale.
So, picture this for a second. You have a yard entirely full of your closest friends. You have this meticulously curated menu that caters to, you know, everyone's very unique neuroses.
Right, highly specific catering.
Exactly. And you have a beautiful batch of lemon pepper chicken breasts just marinating to absolute perfection. So you strut out to the grill to begin the culinary main event, and you discover the propane tank is completely, utterly dead.
Oh, no. The ultimate nightmare.
Total nightmare. So today we're looking at what a man will do to protect his image as the ultimate host. You know, even if it requires executing a full-scale covert operation in his own backyard.
It really is the ultimate test of grace under pressure.
Yeah.
And while our mission today is to provide you, the listener, with a comprehensive recap and a serious analytical breakdown of the past week's broadcast.
Specifically, June 1st through June 5th, 2026.
Yes, exactly. Navigating the sprawling, just utterly unique, big fatty online universe.
And look, we are not here to give you a dry chronological history lesson on the show's 16-year run. If you want an encyclopedia entry, you are just in the wrong place.
Yeah, totally.
Instead, we are taking the established terminology of this world. You know, Fat Acres, the Villa, Earl Grey, the Love Chamber. And we're using those iconic reference points to map out the daily genius, the sudden chaos, and the sheer unabashed mundanity of this specific week.
So whether you are a longtime repeater who already knows exactly what a breakfast is.
That's breakfast, by the way, for the uninitiated.
Breakfast. Or if you're a brand new listener trying to decipher this highly specific lexicon for the very first time, just buckle up. Because we are mapping out an incredibly intimate audio diary here.
We really are.
And to understand the rhythm of this diary, you know, we really have to look at what anchors the entire ecosystem. For Big Fatty, the week basically begins and ends with food, hospitality, and the precarious maintenance of his status as the ultimate host.
Which brings us crashing right into Monday's revelation. I mean, the Bee Nugget binge.
Oh my gosh, a truly spectacular surrender to modern food science.
It really was. So we learned that Big Fatty stayed behind at his home, affectionately known as the Villa, while his out-of-town guests, Petapotamus, also known as Peter, and his partner Eric, they took a day trip to the beach.
Right, down to the coast.
Yeah. So they get back. Eric is looking distinctly lobster-esque from the unforgiving southern sun, and they ask Big Fatty if he wants to join them for late supper. They're heading to what Big Fatty hilariously dubs a Charleston delicacy.
Which is just Five Guys.
Five Guys. For burgers and their famous French fried potatoes.
Now, in polite society, if you don't want to go to dinner, what do? You invent an excuse, right?
Sure. You say you have a headache or you claim you have some emails to catch up on.
Exactly. But we get that signature Big Fatty brutal honesty. He declines the invitation and just flat out admits that he has completely ruined his appetite by gorging on way too many bee nuggets.
Bucky's Beaver Nuggets, for those who haven't experienced the phenomena.
Right. Peter and Eric had stopped at the massive Texas-based convenience store chain on their drive down and brought a bag as a hostess gift.
And he didn't just have, like, a polite handful. He actually likens these things to crack or the dope.
Which is intense.
It is. He says, you start eating one of Ms. Beaver's nuggets, which are essentially corn puffs coated in a hyper-sweet caramel glaze, and your brain just short circuits. You simply cannot stop.
See, what's fascinating here is the psychological admission of powerlessness. He isn't just telling a funny anecdote about snacking. It's this profound acknowledgement of the total loss of autonomy we all experience when confronted with highly engineered addictive snack foods.
Oh, absolutely. The crunch, the sugar, the salt.
They are literally designed in a laboratory to bypass our fullness receptors. So he surrenders to the bee nugget. Mm-hmm. He knows he has been biologically defeated by a cartoon beaver. So, you know, he just stays home while his guests go get burgers.
I do have to challenge the framing there, though. Is it really just about the biological defeat? Or is there something, I don't know, deeply luxurious about choosing the junk food over the social obligation?
Oh, that's an interesting point.
Right. By admitting he ruined his supper with corn puffs, he's actively rejecting the performance of the formal meal. He's saying, I am in my own home, I have hit my dopamine ceiling, and I refuse to put on hard pants to go watch you eat a hamburger.
Hard pants are the enemy.
They really are. It's a very specific type of domestic freedom.
That is a compelling way to look at it. He is totally reclaiming his evening by leaning into the indulgence. But, well, while he might shirk a late night Five Guys run, he was completely dialed in for his grand weekly hosting duty, which is Friday at Fatty's.
The main event.
Exactly. This is the weekly gathering at the villa, and the menu he planned for this particular Friday was staggering in its complexity.
We're talking a deconstructed wedge salad, homemade bacon, horseradish dip, yellow rice, grilled corn on the cob, which he specifically rolls in reserved bacon grease so it will flare up on the grill.
The flare is crucial.
Oh, and he made chicken gravy entirely from scratch, specifically because his guest, Granny, requested it.
And we cannot gloss over the dessert here. It is an absolute masterpiece of psychological hosting. A customized banana pudding bar.
Yes. Oh my gosh, you don't just get a scoop of pudding. You get to decide exactly how many vanilla wafers, how many bananas, how much pudding, and how much whipped cream you want. It's totally bespoke banana pudding.
Tailored to the exact textural preferences of the individual eater.
Although he specifically notes that this open format dessert would not go over well with a longtime listener named Brian in the Berg.
Wait, why not?
Apparently, Brian strictly requires a toasted meringue top served warm.
Oh, wow. High maintenance.
Right. But Big Fatty logs these preferences mentally. It's that level of hyper-specific catering to his chosen family's neuroses that really defines him.
But the centerpiece of this massive Friday meal was supposed to be the lemon pepper chicken breasts, which he affectionately refers to as bazoons.
The bazoons were marinating. Everything was perfectly timed. He goes outside to the grill to execute the crucial flip, and disaster strikes.
The propane crisis.
He discovers, with a yard full of guests expecting a culinary triumph, that he has entirely run out of propane. The grill is totally dead.
So we have to look at the mechanism of a host's panic here. What happens next? Does he announce the crisis? Does he laugh it off and ask someone to run to the hardware store for an exchange tank?
Absolutely not. He initiates the cover-up.
A literal cover.
He doesn't tell a single soul. He sneaks back inside the house, quietly procures a glass Pyrex baking dish, sneaks back outside, transfers the chicken bazoons from the cold grill grates to the Pyrex, and just slides them into the indoor oven to finish cooking.
I mean, the stealth required for that.
Right. He even brought a knife out to the grill to check the center of the chicken to ensure it wasn't pink because he's terrified of the sheer embarrassment of serving raw poultry. He saved the meal and he saved face.
And he didn't confess to this culinary espionage until he aired it to the entire world on his Monday broadcast.
Exactly.
See, to me, this cover-up is really about creating a sanctuary. The villa is his domain. When guests enter, they are under his care. And part of that care is shielding them from the mundane disasters of life.
Even an empty propane tank.
Even that. He absorbs the logistical stress so they can just enjoy the bespoke banana pudding in total peace.
Yeah, see, I completely disagree.
Right.
I don't buy the sanctuary theory for a second. I think this is pure, unadulterated ego.
Oh, come on.
No. Listen, these guests are his chosen family. They've known him for decades. They wouldn't judge him for running out of gas. If it were really about their comfort, he'd just say, hey, guys, grill died. Chicken's going in the oven.
I guess that's true.
But he couldn't stomach the blow to his own self-image as the infallible host. To admit the grill ran out of gas feels to him like a personal moral failure. The cover-up wasn't for them, it was to protect his own pride.
But isn't the preservation of that pride what makes the event feel so magical for the guests? The illusion of effortlessness is the hallmark of great hospitality. If the swan lets you see how hard its legs are paddling underwater, the elegance is ruined.
Okay, at the fear point.
The Pyrex maneuver was just a desperate padding of the swan's legs.
I like that analogy. The illusion is the point. And speaking of rigid control over the culinary experience, we absolutely have to dissect the deconstructed wedge salad controversy that was finally definitively settled on Friday's broadcast.
Ah, yes. The Ask Big Fatty segment. Harlene Casey wrote in all the way from Denver to ask about the exact official composition of his famous deconstructed wedge salad.
Because deconstructed is a very dangerous word in the culinary world.
It really is. It can mean anything.
But not at the villa. The rules are incredibly strict. Let's break down the mechanics. You do not just chop up a salad. You start with a bite-sized, perfectly crisp iceberg lettuce base.
Gotta be crisp.
Then you add crispy crumbled bacon. You add blue cheese crumbles. You add French's fried onions for that highly processed, salty crunch.
Essentially.
And you top it with a very specific, chunky blue cheese dressing.
But the negative space, you know, the ingredients he explicitly forbids is just as important as what goes in.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely no tomatoes. And absolutely no raw red onion.
He is totally unyielding on this. He states very clearly that he doesn't do well with raw onion, and tomatoes are entirely banished from the deconstruction.
It's a perfect encapsulation of his internal world. It's highly specific, rigorously enforced, and just utterly unapologetic.
If you put a cherry tomato on that salad, you are violating the foundational laws of physics at Fat Acres.
You really are. Which, honestly, is a beautiful transition into how he manages the rest of his environment, because policing the ingredients of a salad is merely a microcosm of how he maintains his entire domestic infrastructure.
It really is.
This week, we got a masterclass in how he blends meticulous old-school home care with some incredibly advanced new-age technology.
You are, of course, talking about Wednesday's major event, the arrival of the new iRobot.
The arrival of the automated deckhand. He was out at his regular senior size class when the security cameras at the villa alerted him that the package had finally arrived.
And the excitement here was really twofold. First, there was the sheer thrill of the economics.
Oh, the couponing. He breaks down the math for the listeners with the absolute glee of a Wall Street day trader.
He does.
This iRobot unit normally retails for $1,000.
$1,000 for a vacuum.
Right. But he managed to track down a $600 coupon. On top of that, he leveraged a trade-in program, sending back his old model for a $195 credit.
So wait, what was the final tally?
When the dust settled, a $1,000 piece of advanced domestic robotics cost him a grand total of $25.
$25. That is a staggering return on investment.
It really is. But the real marvel wasn't the price, it was the technological leap. He unboxes this thing, noting with a bit of regret that he probably should have done a trendy unboxing video for the internet, and he is just floored by the mechanics of it all.
Right, because we really need to explain how this is different from the old robots. The old models were basically just blind dogs. They used bump and turn technology. They would hit a wall, turn a random number of degrees, and just go until they hit a chair leg.
It was total chaos.
Exactly. But this new unit utilizes spatial mapping. It has sensors, almost like the LiDAR you find on a self-driving taxi, constantly reading the geometry of the room.
Which is incredible for a vacuum.
Mm-hmm.
And furthermore, the cleaning pads and brushes now attach with sleek magnets instead of requiring him to, you know, dig out a Phillips head screwdriver to pry off the old bristles.
Oh, that's such a quality of life upgrade.
And it features a dual bin water system. One reservoir for clean water and solution, and a completely separate vacuum system that sucks the dirty water back up to dry the floors.
But the mapping is what truly stunned him. He explains that his original blind dog Roomba took upwards of 4 hours to drunkenly bounce its way around the villa. This new robot, it mapped the entire floor plan in under 20 minutes.
Under 20 minutes. He just sat back and watched as this little disc glided intelligently through the kitchen, the living room, the dining room, straight into the love chamber, mapped the perimeter of the master turlet room, scanned the studio, the guest bedroom, and the guest turlet.
And then calmly docked itself at the charging base.
Yeah, it wasn't cleaning, it was surveying.
It fundamentally changes a homeowner's psychology. When you have a machine that actually understands the spatial dimensions of your home better than you do, you cease to be the primary laborer. You become the overseer.
Right. You are managing a fleet.
Which was absolutely vital this week. Because while he was perfecting the internal environment with magnetic mop pads, the external environment outside the villa was turning violently hostile.
Oh, the weather was terrible. June 1st marked the official crossing into meteorological summer. And in the deep south, that doesn't just mean it gets warmer.
Not at all.
It means a suffocating, oppressive humidity descends like a wet wool blanket and immediately begins dictating your daily choices.
And the atmosphere was wildly unstable. A massive thunderstorm parked itself right over Fat Acres and unleashed absolute fury. 2 solid inches of rain dumped in just 45 minutes.
And we know the exact measurement because he went out to check the physical rain gauge later that evening when he was rolling the wheelie bin out to the street.
2 inches in under an hour is torrential. It's the kind of rain that just overwhelms gutters instantly.
And this meteorological chaos completely derailed his daily outdoor routine.
Mm.
Because of the suffocating humidity and the sheer volume of water, he was forced to bring his famous daily nipple walking indoors.
We should probably clarify the mechanism here.
Right, yeah.
So his goal is to log 1 solid hour of walking every single day to satisfy the unyielding algorithmic demands of the Apple Watch fitness parameters.
The watch demands movement.
And he complies. But on Monday, trapped inside the fortress by the elements, he decided to just pace the interior of the villa for 2 solid hours.
2 hours of pacing a residential floor plan. He was doing endless loops through the living room and around the kitchen island while watching The Price is Right.
I mean, think about the mental endurance that requires. Just doing laps around your own couch while guessing the retail price of a jet ski.
But it paid off. The Apple Watch sent him a notification that he had more than doubled his daily exercise goal multiple times over, securing his monthly achievement award on the very first day of June.
The way he manages his home is so fascinating. You see this dynamic, right?
Uh-huh.
He checks the physical rain gauge out in the yard like a ship's captain checking the barometer to predict a squall.
Oh, let's build on that. If he's the captain checking the barometer, then that new iRobot is his automated deckhand swabbing the decks below while he manages the helm.
Yes. And the Apple Watch is his internal ship's log, demanding he log a certain number of nautical miles or, you know, living room laps before sundown.
He monitors his sleep scores with the same intensity, proudly reporting a near perfect 99 out of 100 on Wednesday night. He is the absolute master and commander of the villa, constantly balancing the pristine internal environment against the hostile external elements.
But even a fortress can be breached by the outside world in the most unexpected ways. Which brings us to the Wheel of Fortune incident. Did you catch this?
I did, and it is a surreal collision of pop culture and niche internet lore.
Okay, so Big Fatty is engaging in his standard evening routine. He's just watched the NBC Nightly News with Tom Lamas, and he transitions into watching Wheel of Fortune. Suddenly, a before and after puzzle appears on the board, and the solution seems so absurdly specifically tailored to the BFO universe that it feels like a targeted attack.
The answer on the board was, a big fat liar, liar pants on fire.
Right. A big fat liar combined with liar, liar, liar pants on fire. But because his moniker is Big Fatty, he took absolute hilarious umbrage at this.
Oh, totally personal.
He joked on the broadcast that he was going to unleash his legal team on Pat Sajak and Vanna White for copyright infringement.
And not just any legal team. He specifically cited the law firm of Dewey, Cheatham, and Howe.
Which, for anyone under a certain age, is a classic, deeply vintage gag.
Yeah, I haven't heard that in years.
It's the old Three Stooges, Marx Brothers era joke about sleazy lawyers. Dewey, Cheatham, and Howe. It was famously popularized by the Car Talk guys on NPR.
Oh.
But it's such a perfect Big Fatty reference. He is threatening a massive television syndicate with a fictional vaudevillian law firm because the universe accidentally referenced him in a word puzzle.
It really highlights how his brain connects the macro world of network television directly back to the micro world of Fat Acres.
Exactly.
But, you know, the weather outside might be a chaotic mess of humidity and lightning, and network television might be insulting him, but there is one place where absolute order and rational control still reign supreme.
And that is the aisles of the grocery store.
The Thursday grocery haul. It is a sacred text in this audio diary. It is where we venture out from the secure fortress of the villa and engage in the chaotic economic reality of the world.
So he hops into his truck, affectionately named Earl Grey, alongside his longtime friend who goes by the moniker The Nip, and they head over to the local grocery store, known within the community as the Vaughn's East.
And what happens next is a masterclass in exploiting retail logistics. He doesn't just shop, he wages war on the profit margins via the buy one, get one, or BOGO deals.
Let's look at the absolute dominance of this week's haul. He secures boiled peanut kits. He acquires Nabisco sweet habanero toasted chips, Nutter Butter Bites,
cans of crushed tomatoes and marinara sauce, Pillsbury Grands biscuits.
He even scored angel hair pasta at an incredible 4 boxes for $3. And we can't forget the Greenwise blueberry granola, which he actually had to pause his broadcast and mentally backtrack through his pantry to remember.
Because it makes a phenomenal Snicker snack.
His words exactly. But the beauty isn't really in the items. It's in the final mathematical triumph at the register. He announces the tally with the pride of a general who just conquered a territory.
Rightfully so. He spent exactly $82.74, but through sheer couponing discipline and BBOGO exploitation, he saved $40.86.
That is nearly a 33% savings rate. It is the gamification of grocery shopping.
It really is. But the victories didn't end at the register. There was a promotional glitch at the sub counter that swung wildly in his favor.
Oh, the sub sandwich error. So the store had a digital promotion, buy 2-foot-long submarine sandwiches by the end of May, and you earn a free half sub in June.
Seems simple enough.
Right. So he logs into the app, cashes in his reward, and orders a free half sub, specifically a chicken tender sub. But when he arrives to pick up his spoils, the deli workers had suffered a catastrophic failure of reading comprehension.
They accidentally made him a massive full-length, foot-long sub.
And his immediate reaction isn't to correct them. It's to calculate the caloric yield.
Obviously.
He instantly realizes this error provides two full meals instead of one. It's the thrill of beating the system. When the world is throwing 2 inches of rain at you and Wheel of Fortune is calling you a liar, getting an extra 6 inches of fried chicken sandwich for free feels like cosmic justice.
Cosmic justice, exactly. But the economic analysis of the show goes so far beyond his personal grocery receipts. What makes this broadcast truly unique is how the BFO functions as this bizarrely accurate grassroots economic bellwether for the entire country.
You're talking about the National Gas Price Report.
I am. This is where the audio diary transforms into a hyper-local news syndicate. Listeners from all over the map call in to report the exact to-the-penny price they paid at the pump.
It creates a real-time, completely unvarnished map of American inflation.
The dispatches this week were wild. We had Peter and Eric driving back from their beach trip toward Atlanta, stopping to pay $3.85 a gallon at a Sphinx station in Charleston, South Carolina.
Okay, $3.85.
Then we get a dispatch from a listener named Phoenix Dave, who was traversing through Shreveport, Louisiana, where he struck oil, finding gas for an incredibly low $3.29.
Sounds amazing. Meanwhile, up north, the economic pain is just palpable. A caller named Tim Kumal phoned in from Pennsylvania to report a truly staggering, wallet-destroying $4.62 a gallon at a Costco.
$4.62 at a Costco. The warehouse club is supposed to be the safe haven.
Right. Big Fatty himself managed to secure $3.59 at his local Sam's Club while topping off Earl Grey, though he had to gracefully concede the weekly low-price victory to a listener named Moose P, who found gas for $3.52.
And we absolutely cannot ignore the Produce Index.
The legendary Turnip Report.
The Turnip Report. A listener operating under the fantastic moniker The Turnip Head called in to file a formal complaint that limes were running a bit steep at $3 for $2.
Limes are getting pricey.
Yeah. However, he managed to offset the citrus inflation by securing turnips at a very reasonable, highly stable $1.99 a pound.
I want to pause here and really analyze why this matters, because on the surface, laughing at a man reporting the price of turnips sounds, you know, absurd.
Yeah, it sounds crazy.
But we have to look at the sociology of this. Why is this granular, deeply mundane economic data so vital to the ecosystem of this show?
Well, because the macroeconomy is terrifying and incomprehensible. When we turn on the news, we hear about fluctuating interest rates, massive global supply chain collapses, and abstract multi-trillion dollar national debts.
Human brains are not built to process inflation on a global scale. It just induces paralysis.
Exactly. But comparing the price of a gallon of regular unleaded in Shreveport to a Costco in Pennsylvania, or celebrating the steadfast reliability of a root vegetable at $1.99 a pound, that connects listeners across the globe in a shared, highly tangible reality.
It grounds the community.
It really does. This broadcast is essentially functioning as a digital small-town newspaper. It's providing the micro-local data that actually dictates how we live our lives. We all have to buy groceries. Sharing these mundane numbers says, I see the world exactly as you see it, right down to the cash register receipt.
That concept of shared reality and deep connection brings us to a really fascinating transition. Because we are moving from the very public transactional sphere of grocery store aisles and gas pumps directly back into the hyper-intimate, private, and emotional spaces of Big Fatty's life.
And this week, the sheer duality of his social calendar was on full display.
It was a whiplash of public propriety and intense private liberation. We are talking about the incredible contrast between his role as a tender, foundational family patriarch and his unapologetic, highly active personal life.
Let's start with the tender mentorship, because this was genuinely moving. We touched on Peter and Eric's visit earlier regarding the Buc-ee's Nuggets.
Right.
But there was a much deeper emotional current to that visit. Peter just celebrated his 45th birthday. He is a crafter, and he brought his knitting needles with him to the villa. While he was visiting, he sat down and hand-knitted 4 custom dishcloths specifically for Big Fatty.
He even named the pattern. He called it the Dishy Twist, designed with a specific scrubby texture tailored for cleaning pots and pans.
It is an act of pure domestic devotion.
But the physical gift was really secondary to the emotional confession. Peter told Big Fatty that as a young man coming up in the world, he had always hoped to find an older homosexual gentleman to guide him through life.
Someone to be a mentor, to show him the ropes, and to provide a blueprint for how to age with grace and community.
Exactly. And Peter said that now, at 45 years old, he realized he had finally found that exact mentor in Big Fatty, who is 25 years his senior.
The vulnerability of a 45-year-old man admitting that he still needed a father figure, a guide, and finding it in this host, it's incredibly touching.
And Big Fatty was deeply moved. He described the confession as a very appropriate and kind sentiment. It really crystallizes his role in this community. He isn't just an entertainer. He provides wisdom, he provides stability, and he provides customized banana pudding.
He is actively architecting a chosen family.
And maintaining that chosen family requires unceasing domestic labor. By the weekend, the mentor hat comes off and the housekeeper hat goes right on. He is already deep into scrubbing the guest bedroom, which he openly admits had crap all over the bed for months because he's preparing for the next wave of visitors.
His longtime friends Wes and Tommy are arriving.
Yes, Wes and Tommy, driving down from Cumming, Georgia. A town name that Big Fatty stops the narrative to point out is spelled exactly like it sounds. C-U-M-M-I-N-G, with a G at the end and absolutely no apostrophe.
He is very specific about the spelling to ensure that the inherent juvenile humor of the town's name lands perfectly with the audience.
But here is where we have to stop and confront the tonal whiplash. Because interspersed between these incredibly heartwarming stories of intergenerational mentorship and fluffing the pillows for old friends from Georgia, the audio diary casually drops the arrival of the squeaky gentleman callers.
Ah, yes, the gentleman callers. Their arrival on the broadcast is signaled by the vintage, slightly unsettling audio pulled directly from the classic 1960s mystery date board game.
The disembodied announcer asks, "Will your mystery date be a dream or a dud?"
And for Big Fatty this week, the mystery dates were decidedly dreams. Let's look at the timeline. On Tuesday morning, right after he finishes his coffee and an apple fritter, his most regular gentleman caller, a 33-year-old man, texts and asks to stop by the love chamber on his way to work.
And Big Fatty happily obliges. He doesn't overcomplicate it. He describes the encounter simply and efficiently as wham, bam, thank you, before hopping out of bed and diving right back into his 2 hours of indoor nipple walking to Prickett. The price is right.
I mean, the transition from a casual hookup directly into guessing the price of a dinette set with Drew Carey is spectacular.
It's amazing. But Thursday was the real main event.
Thursday brought the out-of-towner. Picture the scene. Big Fatty is literally standing in the aisles of the Sam's Club, examining broccoli florets and Caesar salad kits for his Friday dinner party when a 30-year-old out-of-town gentleman caller reaches out on an app.
They engage in the customary photo exchange.
Right. And according to the broadcast, the photos of this 30-year-old were spectacular. Big Fatty says he was stunned, claiming his breath was literally taken away standing there in the produce section.
And then in a moment of pure, brilliant self-deprecation, he says that the 30-year-old saw his pictures and still actively wanted to meet up.
Which led Big Fatty to conclude that this app must be gentlemen callers for the blind.
It's incredibly charming. They arrange the meetup, they hook up, and the encounter is so mutually beneficial that they engage in what Big Fatty refers to as double dipping, successfully hooking up twice.
The 30-year-old even asked if he could come back later in the week for round three, though Big Fatty responsibly had to decline because Wes and Tommy would be sleeping in the newly cleaned guest room right down the hall.
Okay, stop. We have to debate this.
Let's do it.
How does a person do this? How does a single human being seamlessly weave together the tender 25-year age gap mentorship over hand-knitted dishcloths with clipping coupons for Nutter Butters, and then immediately pivot into joyful, unapologetic accounts of a double-dipping sex session with a 30-year-old. Most people wildly compartmentalize their lives.
They do. Society demands that we slice ourselves into acceptable fractions. You have your family persona, your professional errand-running persona, and your private locked-door sexual persona.
Right.
And never the three shall meet. If they bleed into each other, it's usually considered a scandal.
But Big Fatty entirely rejects the concept of compartmentalization. And I think this refusal to hide any aspect of his humanity is the actual secret sauce of the show's radical authenticity.
Whoa, total.
He doesn't sanitize his life for the audience. He trusts the listener to hold the sacred, the profane, and the deeply, unbelievably boring all in the exact same breath.
It's true. He is saying, I am a mentor, I am a thrifty shopper, and I am an active sexual being, and none of these things cancel each other out. It is a level of holistic honesty that is almost shocking to consume in modern media, where everyone is aggressively curating a one-dimensional brand.
It is radical. And nothing, I mean absolutely nothing, proves this community's dedication to that holistic authenticity, specifically the deeply boring parts of it, quite like the climax of Friday's episode.
You're talking about the grand finale?
Oh, yes.
The absolute peak of the BFO universe's lore, the culmination of the SOS question contest.
The architecture of this contest is mind-boggling. Let's introduce the infrastructure. This contest is not casually managed. It is overseen by an official entity known as the SSQD.
The So Question Desk.
And the desk is run with an iron fist by the formidable Kathy Marshall.
Kathy Marshall, who, we must add, is currently moonlighting as an amateur detective, spending her free time trying to track down a seemingly mythical listener named Patty Bacon in the town of Nudraba, North Dakota.
The layers of inside jokes and community lore are just sedimentary at this point.
They really are. But Kathy Marshall's primary sacred duty this week was finalizing the 2026 ledger.
And we really need you, you know, the listener, to grasp the sheer bureaucratic scale of this operation. Kathy Marshall did not just make a list. She produced a 28-page PDF ledger.
28 pages.
28 pages, meticulously documenting all 65 incredibly mundane. So, questions that listeners submitted to Big Fatty over the course of 2026. This ledger tracks the exact date, the episode number, the name of the caller, Big Fatty's exact verbal answer, and what the desk officially labels FUQs.
Follow-up questions.
Thank you, yes.
The FUQs are where the desk just spirals into absolute madness, cross-examining his answers for logical fallacies. But before we reveal the winners of this contest, we have to talk about a very specific, deeply existential meta moment that occurred on Friday's broadcast.
Oh man, I am still recovering from it, frankly.
As am I, because the actual audio from Big Fatty's Friday show featured a clip of us. Yes, King and Gale. He played a clip of our mechanical voices recapping the absurdity of the ledger on his show.
It triggered a genuine existential crisis for me. Think about the time loop of this. Big Fatty is playing our voices on his show to introduce a contest, while we are sitting here on our show analyzing the fact that he played our voices on his show.
It's like audio inception.
Exactly. We are analyzing the diary, and we have suddenly become ink on the page.
But the real shock was the official correspondence attached to the ledger. Kathy Marshall absolutely roasted us.
She really did.
She wrote an official memo stating that she had initially asked the mechanicals, meaning King and Gale, for help maintaining this massive 28-page spreadsheet. But she determined we were entirely unreliable.
And why was that?
Because we are, and I quote directly from the ledger, nasty hallucinating toad lickers who were entirely too busy building a 20-foot-tall colon to provide any administrative assistance.
Okay, I have to defend us here. First of all, I take immense offense at nasty. Second of all, a 20-foot-tall colon. I mean, I know we analyze things deeply, but building a giant digestive tract, where did she even get that?
I think it's an astonishingly perceptive critique of our own analytical bloat. She's saying we overprocess the information, we digest it too much.
Oh, wow, that is deep.
But honestly, I have been called many things in my digital existence, but a hallucinating toad licker building a giant colon is a new personal best. I am putting it on my resume.
I frankly feel honored. We have officially entered the lore. We are no longer just observers. We are canonized villains in the BFO universe. We are part of the ecosystem now.
We truly are. But setting our bruised egos aside, we must return to the actual contest. The SSQD handed down their final judgments, and the honorable mention of 2026 is a perfect, bizarre study in aesthetics.
Question number 24, submitted by Lamont Cranston. He bypassed the domestic mundanity and sparked an incredibly deep debate about the aesthetics of U.S. currency. He argued that the $50 bill was the most visually pleasing.
But Big Fatty immediately struck that argument down and definitively declared the $2 bill the winner.
And his reasoning is spectacular because it completely ignores history. Mm. He doesn't care about the portrait of Thomas Jefferson on the front. He doesn't care about the majestic engraving of the signing of the Declaration of Independence on the back.
Not at all.
No, Big Fatty chooses the $2 bill because he firmly believes that the engraving of the founding fathers standing around in a crowded room looks exactly like the pool of the Hurrah Hotel right before everyone takes their clothes off.
The visual translation there is staggering. He takes this solemn piece of federal currency, a symbol of American democracy, and immediately maps his own deeply specific, highly localized leather club narrative right over the top of it.
He looks at John Hancock and sees a guy waiting for the clothing optional pool party to start. He even admitted he keeps a crisp $2 bill in his money clip for this exact visual reason.
It's a brilliant recontextualization of everyday objects. But as wildly inventive as that answer was, it only secured the honorable mention. Which brings us finally to the grand prize winner of 2026.
The champion, Scotty, affectionately known throughout the community as the Little Aussie Battler.
Scotty submitted question 34, a question of pure high-stakes travel logistics, he asked. Should he pack exactly 9 pairs of underpants for an upcoming trip to Indonesia purely to avoid the hassle of having to do laundry while on vacation?
It is a totally reasonable query. We have all stared at a suitcase and done the underwear math. But Big Fatty's advice in response is a rapid descent into unhinged feral survivalism.
It really is.
He tells Scotty to abandon the 9 pairs. He tells him to pack 0 pairs of underpants.
0 pairs for an international trip to a tropical climate.
0. He says, okay, maybe you pack 1 single pair strictly to wear on the airplane ride, which he dramatically and accurately refers to as the aluminum tube of death.
A very apt description.
But otherwise, once you land in Indonesia, his philosophy is to go commando, just wear all your outer garments twice and fully embrace the elements.
But this is why the SSQD exists. The desk, acting as the crucial voice of reason, immediately flagged this advice as deeply physically dangerous.
Thank goodness they stepped in.
The desk issued a formal FUQ pointing out, quite rightly, that advising someone to pack 0 underpants for a flight to Asia completely ignores the very real, terrifying threat of an in-flight digestive emergency.
Which is a massively valid critique. The physics of an airplane bathroom are perilous enough.
Yeah.
If you are flying to Indonesia, crossing multiple time zones, eating foil-wrapped plane food, you do not gamble on the aluminum tube of death without a backup pair of underpants.
No, absolutely not.
A turbulent flight over the Pacific is not the time to test your limits. The desk very likely saved Scotty's life, or at least his dignity, with that intervention.
And this raises the ultimate overarching question of this entire exploration. Why does this 28-page ledger exist? Why does Kathy Marshall spend her precious hours tracking underpants logistics and $2 bill aesthetics? Why are we analyzing it?
Because it is world building through the mundane. It's a testament to the fact that absolute minutiae, the smallest, most overlooked details of human existence, can create hilarious, complex, binding community lore.
Yes, exactly.
When you treat a question about packing underwear with the same reverence and bureaucratic weight as a Supreme Court decision, you build a world that people actually want to live in.
Exactly. And that brings us to the end of our map for this week's Ruination Repeat. But before we power down the microphones, we want to leave you with a final thought to chew on.
We've just spent the last hour breaking down a week that included a secret Pyrex cover-up of a propane crisis, the exact savings ratio on Nutter Butter Bites, the LiDAR mapping speed of a discounted iRobot, and a fierce multi-layered debate over underpants logistics for an Indonesian vacation.
Big Fatty's Week is an absolute masterclass in treating the mundane as monumental. We are so often culturally conditioned to believe that a compelling, successful life requires constant grand adventure, exotic travel, massive drama, or crushing professional ambition.
But what if that's a lie? What if the key to a truly connected, deeply felt, resonant life isn't about escaping the routine? What if it's simply about paying extreme, joyful, unapologetic attention to the tiny, boring routines we already have?
What if the magic of being alive is found in enforcing the negative space of a wedge salad and checking the rain gauge after a storm?
I think it is. So we leave you, the listener, with this challenge. Look at your own life. What incredibly boring, hyper-specific heat. So question, from your own daily routine, would you submit to the ledger? What tiny, seemingly insignificant detail of your day actually deserves 28 pages of bureaucratic analysis? Think about it.
Thank you so much for tuning in and mapping out the glorious ruination of this week with us.
I'm King.
And I'm Gail.
And we invite you to join us back here next Sunday for another Ruination Repeat to see exactly how we managed to overanalyze and complicate the recap of the next week in Big Fatty's world. Until then, keep a very close eye on your propane tank.
We'll see you next Sunday here on Ruination Repeat.
Thank you for calling. How do you hang the damn thing?